Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, uncovering a pattern of abuse in Scouting America in a ride-along program.
And former D-backs pitcher Randy Johnson on his new book of photography.
But first, Sedona might have a reputation as a new age mecca of yoga and meditation, but its city government has been embroiled in internal controversy for months as its mayor and police chief have exchanged accusations of misconduct. Late last month, the mayor resigned after being censured by the city council. Now, a review made public late last week reveals the now former mayor, Scott Joblo, created a hostile work environment for the city's police chief, Stephanie Foley. The report was conducted by an outside investigator and found that Joblo undermined and interfered with Foley's management of the Sedona Police Department. It concluded that he tried to force her removal. While that was happening, social media posts accusing Joblo of misusing city money and sexual harassment also came up. There were accusations that Joblo brought a, quote, old-school East Coast mentality to the city government. And while he was cleared of those allegations of misusing funds and sexual harassment, they paint a picture of absolute turmoil in the government of one of Arizona's most picturesque cities. With me to discuss all of this is KJZZ's Michelle Marisco, who has been covering it all for us. Michelle, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Okay, so there is a lot to unpack here. Let's start with Joblo's resignation.
Yeah, thanks, Lauren. Yeah, this fight simmered for a long, finally came out into the open during a council meeting September 10. Here is the city council after it came out of an executive session.
Joblo has engaged in conduct that violates the Sedona City Council rules of procedure and has lost the confidence of the council, staff, and the public. And whereas these actions include, but may not be limited to, one, interference with city staff and departments, two, fostering a hostile work environment.
There are some serious condemnations of the mayor here, Michelle, but was there a sense that things were kind of more personal between Joblo and the city council?
Yeah, so Joblo at the time was deeply personal. There was a lot of back and forth with the city manager, of course, with the chief of police, who had herself filed a 157-page complaint against the mayor. And, he didn't resign. He refused to resign, as you're about to hear, at least at that city council. He apologized profusely. He apologized to the community, saying he overstepped his role, to staff, to the city manager. But this is what he also said.
I will leave it to the voters. I will not be resigning. I feel that it's the voters who put me in place. If a recall takes place, I will follow that and see where we go.
So he stressed that he served Sedona since 2014 and said that he felt he accomplished positive things for the city.
Okay, so the council voted to censure him and overruled him. And then, of course, he resigned 2 weeks later. Let's back up for a moment, though, Michelle, and just remind us first how this all began.
So back in March of last year, Joblo was accused by the former city manager of pushing for these automated license plate readers to be installed throughout Sedona. The Sedona Red Rock News, one of the area's news services, published the public records conversations that showed the behind-the-scenes talks that were happening. And in those conversations, Joblo was accused of pressing city officials hard to get those cameras up and running. And then ultimately last month, the city council rejected those cameras. They were being installed by a company called Flock. And they rejected Flock's cameras and then severed its contract with that company.
Okay, so now we have this investigation that's come to light nearly a month later. What does it say the mayor did?
The investigation found some of that old school mentality the council complained about. Chief Foley made her accusations this summer in that 157-page complaint I referenced. She accused Diablo of targeting her since she was promoted to chief more than 3 years ago. That included micromanaging her, undermining her with staff, and attempting to intervene with the police department's policies. Diablo is former law enforcement himself. His bio says that he worked for the New York for the Port Authority in New York and New Jersey for 30 years before coming to Sedona.
Okay, and so the city has turned to the vice mayor to take up the remainder of Diablo's term. But does this kind of end the strife there within the city council, Michel?
I don't think so. Sedona has been wrestling with issues related to its growth, to its short-term rental programs, how to find housing for people who work in town but can't afford to live there. Recently, the public safety with the flock cameras came up. There have been issues with the housing director for the city. And, you know, we'll have to see how the new city leaders get along, not only with themselves within the council, but also with the administrations.
Okay. So before we let you go, Michel, you actually got the former mayor on the phone to talk about all of this. Tell us what he had to say.
Yeah, Diablo, first off, he said he doesn't regret his decision to resign.
No. I mean, I do because it's the end of a 11-year career that I've given to the community. But I feel that to lose the confidence of five of my council members, and by the way, it came about to the public, it just is time, or was time.
But since resigning, Diablo has continued to criticize the city council. Is he standing by what he said?
Yes, he said the city officials blamed him for pushing him towards obtaining those license plate readers. The council later rejected. He said he looked into the cameras because of his expertise as a law enforcement officer.
All right. Sounds like the sort of remark the city council accused him of before. So that is KJZZ's Michel Marisco joining us with all of the goings on in Sedona. Michel, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Wildfires can negatively impact water quality even after they're extinguished. And new research shows those negative impacts can last for up to 8 years. Carly Brucker led the study of 100,000 samples from 500 watersheds across the western U.S. Their findings? Contaminants like nitrogen, phosphorus, and carbon were in that water and in some cases stayed in it for years. Brucker recently got her PhD from the University of Colorado Boulder and now works as a water resources engineer in Colorado. She says there have been a number of studies looking at the post-wildfire impacts on water quality, but that this is one of the first showing those impacts can last as long as 8 years after a while. She says that longevity is one of the study's more striking findings. She joins me to talk more about this. And Carly, am I right that this is a lot longer than scientists had thought water quality problems could last after a wildfire?
Yes and no. I think we kind of just didn't know. I mean, it's really difficult to conduct a fieldwork study where you're going out into a field collecting samples after a wildfire happened. It's hard to do that for more than 2 or 3 years in terms of funding and resources. And so there's only really a handful of studies that had actually looked at these impacts past 2 to 3 years. And so, you know, we didn't really know what happened after those first couple of years. And I think that this study helps us get more of a look into that.
Yeah. Were there variables that helped determine for how long the negative impacts would last in terms of maybe how many acres the fire burned or where it burned or where the watershed was relative to the fire, anything like that?
Yeah. So we looked at a couple of different characteristics, both the watershed characteristics, such as vegetation and soil type. But then also we looked at the burn characteristics, like you mentioned, where the fire burned in the watershed, how long it burned, the severity. And And one of the key things that came out of that was the amount of forest coverage. So the watersheds that had a higher amount of the total area that was covered by forests, those ones had a slightly higher water quality response, which makes sense. You know, trees provide a lot of fuel that can result in greater amounts of sediment being pushed downstream. But that was kind of the biggest thing that we saw.
Did you find that the water quality got better over time? Like, was it still as bad in year eight as it was in year one after a fire?
Yeah. So for all of the different water quality constituents we looked at, we did see a gradual improvement over time. Some of them were surprisingly slow. You know, at year eight, the magnitude was only a little bit less than at year three, for example. But overall, they all trended downwards, kind of returning back to what they looked like before the fire.
Well, I guess that's decent news, right? That while maybe it takes a little bit longer to get there than we thought, it does eventually get there.
Definitely, yes. And definitely the worst impacts, I would say, did happen in those first couple of years. So in terms of preparing for these potential effects, I think that, you know, water managers can expect to really have the greatest challenges within those first couple of years.
Well, so let me ask you about preparation. I mean, as you know, we saw wildfires in and around Los Angeles, you know, Arizona, of course, is no stranger to pretty severe wildfires. Like, what should water managers be doing about this to try to protect the water quality for folks who maybe rely on the water that is in the areas of these fires?
Yeah, so I think that's the question of the hour. I think that is what all water managers are, especially those in the West, are trying to grapple with and figure out next steps. And the answer is there's a lot of different things. On sort of the wildfire mitigation side, there's a lot of steps that can be taken to decrease the chances of wildfires happening, decrease the severity that the wildfires are burning at. You know, decreasing the amount of like vegetation in a certain area can really help with that. But then, you know, in the event that the wildfire does happen, it really impacts water quality. Water managers are looking towards making sure that the distribution and treatment systems are resilient enough and have high enough capacity to be able to handle these really large loads of sediment and these really poorly degraded waters.
Are the typical processes that maybe municipalities have to treat water that's going into people's taps, can that handle everything that is in the water after a wildfire? Or maybe do they need additional or special equipment to do that?
So typically, water treatment plants are not set up to have the capacity to handle a big water quality degradation event like a wildfire. Water managers have backups in place. Often what will happen is that really low quality water will be diverted and they'll be able to rely on an alternate source while the water is poorly degraded, and then switch back to using that source eventually. But typically, yeah, water treatment plants wouldn't have the capacity to be able to treat that water and deliver the high quality water that they're used to delivering before the wildfire happened.
Yeah. Well, and I would imagine that if they were to get additional treatment options, I'm sure that comes at a cost, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think especially in smaller, more rural areas where resources might be a little bit more limited, an event like that could be completely devastating to a utility and just result in costs that are really hard to meet.
How concerning are these findings to you?
I would say, you know, I've had so many different conversations with water managers and folks who work at utilities over the years, and almost every single one of them is concerned about wildfires. You know, it's on everyone's mind. Everyone has a story of a neighbor or a nearby utility that got completely shut down from a wildfire or just really struggled to handle the impacts. And so I think that the concern is out there. I think that water managers are already concerned. And I think that this research just emphasizes that a little bit more and puts some more concrete numbers behind that concern.
And as you were saying, though, it sounds like, as in so many facets of life, prevention might be the best cure. Like, if you can prevent these severe, massive wildfires from happening, you prevent some of the worst degradation to water quality.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's something that folks are increasingly turning towards is forest management. There are more studies that are coming out that are showing that, you know, having a healthy forest that's not overgrown, that's not going to be a good source of fuel for a really high severity fire is a really great preventative method to sort of, you know, stop some of these really bad water quality degradation events from happening.
All right. Well, Carly, thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Carly Brucker is a water resources engineer in Colorado and lead author of the study on multi-year water quality degradation after wildfires. Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Earlier this summer, a Border Patrol agent in Yuma was charged with 15 felony counts after he allegedly sexually abused a 16-year-old girl. The girl was part of a mentorship program meant to provide experience and exposure to careers in law enforcement. That case is currently making its way through Yuma County Superior Court, but it isn't the only one of its kind. In fact, our next guest found this youth program, dubbed the Explorers, has faced more than 200 allegations of abuse. It's overseen by the Boy Scouts, now called Scouting America. And the investigative reporter coming up next tracked down the records for the Marshall Project, and I spoke with her more about it.
This program, Explorers, is a type of youth vocational program that was created by the Boy Scouts of America a really long time ago, back in the 70s. And it is a way for teenagers age 14 to 21 into young adulthood for them to learn about a specific career field. So exploring programs exist for a lot of different careers, like, you know, medical fields or firefighter fields, but they are very popular among law enforcement agencies, so police departments and sheriff's offices. And the key perk of this program, especially for law enforcement exploring, is ride-alongs, where participants can accompany an officer as they go on patrol in their vehicle.
Okay. So a perk of the program, but you found a disturbing and very lengthy history of abuse in programs like that, and specifically to do with ride-alongs, right? Tell us what you found.
Exactly. So like I said, ride-alongs are a key perk, but what we found in our reporting is that it is also a gateway to abuse. So let's take a step back and talk about the two big safety policies that the Boy Scouts have for their youth programs. So one is a 2-deep leadership. So two adults have to be present for all programming. And the other one is no one-on-one contact. So there cannot be one adult alone with a participant.
Right.
But what scouting did for this program up until very recently is that they actually carved out an exception for law enforcement exploring. So for ride-alongs, this one-on-one contact was allowed. And what we found is that in the 220 cases of abuse that we have documented, about a quarter of the abuse and the misconduct began on ride-alongs where this type of isolation was allowed.
Wow, a quarter. Okay. So one case happened here in Arizona. Tell us about this case out of Yuma involving a Border Patrol agent and a ride-along.
In May, prosecutors charged 31-year-old Ramon Marquez with multiple counts of charges related to sexual abuse involving a minor. This was a 16-year-old Explorer participant who was a participant for the Customs and Border Protection's Explorer program. They have one too. Mm-hmm. And so he was arrested. He is, of course, facing those charges. And I believe this week he is due back in court for a trial date to be set and for a change of plea. When I was looking into the charging documents, one of the things that stood out is that the alleged abuse took place in multiple locations, including in his police vehicle, mm-hmm. As he was transporting her to and from Explorer events.
Yeah, yeah. And that's just one of several active ride-along abuse cases across the country that you uncovered. Is there any way to track just how many incidents like this there are?
There is not, which is quite unfortunate. You know, there are some law firms who are handling lots of the lawsuits against scouting for allegations of abuse. They have tried to compile as much as they can. But if you want to search, you know, a deeply comprehensive public database to try to see the extent of this abuse, one does not exist. In fact, the analysis that we did to gain better insight into how much of this abuse and misconduct was occurring on ride-alongs is the first of its kind. Mm. So this is work that we have tried to do in some ways from scratch to understand the prevalence.
Okay. So tell us then, why, Lakhidra, are ride-alongs so prone to abuse?
Yeah. So for this reporting, I spoke with a lot of experts who focus specifically on preventing child sexual abuse and youth serving organizations, which is an organization like Scouting. Yeah. And two of the points that they made is that in order to prevent this type of abuse, you need, one, for the activity to be observable, so an outside party to be able to see what is going on.
Right.
And the second is for that activity to be interruptible. So when a participant is on a ride-along with an officer, no one can see what is happening in that vehicle. It is not immediately observable. And second, no one can intervene if something is happening. It's not interruptible.
Right. So as you described, there was up until recently a carve out in Scouting America's kind of rules about how adults and children can interact for this program. That no longer exists. Is there now any kind of oversight of cases like this by Scouting America?
Yeah. So the rule change that was put into place while we were reporting this story, Scouting declined to do an interview with us. They did not respond to our questions, but they did update their policies to say that they're looking into them. They are changing them. And the rule that they have put in place now for law enforcement exploring and for ride-alongs is that two adults must be present, including, during these car rides. And that if one of the participants is an underage female explorer, then at least one of the officers accompanying her must also be a female officer.
Is Border Patrol still connected to this program?
Yeah, so Border Patrol, again, has a lot of these explorer programs, and I am not aware of them ending this program because of this these allegations against their former officer, Ramon Marquez. Mm. I did reach out to Customs and Border Protection, and they declined to come.
What should parents of kids in programs like these know? Like, should they allow their children to be involved, in your opinion?
In my opinion, I will give you the opinion of a researcher that I spoke with, okay. Who, again, looks at preventing this type of sexual abuse. And when I spoke with him and I shared the findings, he was, one, not surprised. He felt like ride-alongs, abuse on ride-alongs, it was a known problem. And then he went on to say that if he still had teenage daughters, that he would not recommend that his daughters participate in law enforcement exploring. And that was very similar with other experts that I spoke to, this real hesitancy to have youth involved in this type of program. They felt there were better ways for young people to learn about law enforcement that did not involve, you know, things like ride-alongs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, broadly speaking, what I would tell parents from what I have learned looking into this program is to, if they are able to be very involved in the program, try to sit in on the type of training that their teenagers have as Explorer participants, go to the competitions, and to just be very present, to ask for, to see the paperwork. There's a memorandum of understanding that agencies have to have with scouting. Ask to see that. Ask to see the rule book that agencies have created to understand what the policies are and what the accountability measures are, and to what extent they exist. How will your department not only protect the participants, but hold that officer accountable?
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. Lakedra Chavis, investigative reporter and former staff writer for the Marshall Project, joining us. Lakedra, thank you for your reporting here. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Randy Johnson is best known as a Hall of Fame pitcher, a five-time Cy Young Award winner, and world champion with the Arizona Diamondbacks. But in his post-baseball career, he's traded his mitt for a lens. He's had exhibits of his photography and now has a book out documenting his travels in Africa called Experiencing Africa. He'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore tonight to talk about it. Johnson studied photojournalism while he was in college at USC, and when I spoke with him yesterday, I asked what led him back to photography in his post-baseball life.
Well, because I started traveling then. I wasn't traveling to ballparks and playing baseball anymore, and I was traveling and enjoying what people do when, you know, they're retired with my family, and I was just seeing things that I thought were amazing and for the first time, and I thought it was great to take pictures of them, and then I started peeling the layers away on various trips and started going to different locations and different trips, and then inevitably, you know, discovered Africa, and that was one reason why I've traveled there so many times, because there are so many different places to go in Africa.
Yeah, what appeals to you so much about that continent? Your new book is shots from Africa, photos from Africa. What appeals to you about that place?
Well, I just think the animals, the people, there was so much that Africa offered, and it wasn't just animals. You know, I went trekking up into the Rwandan mountains to see silverback gorillas. I went to Ethiopia two times, so not only was it a great photography experience. Hence the photography exhibits I was able to have because of it, but also the coffee table book, but also the cultural experience that I got from it, and learning more about Africa and the people there in Ethiopia and the culture and the lifestyle and their daily routine. So it just appealed to me, not to say that I don't like traveling other places, it's just a destination that, you know, I'm very comfortable with, and I feel like I'm just scratching the surface there.
Hmm. Do you find that when you are shooting photos that you are leaning on the skills you learned in college? I mean, have you taken classes or anything besides
that? I was back in the 80s. I mean, I barely even use a film camera. I do have one and I do use it, but I mean, that was back in 1983 through 85. So we're talking, that was a long time ago, and I've learned a lot more since then. Everything's digital, and, you know, I'm on YouTube learning how to, you know, do things and edit and things like that. So, I mean, just like baseball, I've come, you know, I came a long ways in baseball by going out there and doing it and correcting my mistakes. And it's the same thing, same process you would do with anything, hence my photography.
Yeah. Do you see similarities between photography, the kind you're doing now, and being a pitcher?
Taking pictures and actually throwing pitches is about the only thing, you know, not really. I mean, I guess there's some focus that has to go into both of them, but, you know, baseball was my livelihood. Photography is a passion. It keeps my mind right and keeps me busy and occupied.
I've read where you've said that you prefer shooting landscape scenes, shooting nature, as opposed to, for example, sporting events. I'm curious why that is.
Well, because I I've been playing sports my whole life since I was 7 years old, and I retired when I was 46. So a good chunk of my life was playing sports. And so why wouldn't I want to see other parts of the world and other things that the world has to offer and capture those through photography and be able to share those experiences?
Are you somebody who, if you are traveling somewhere, always has a camera with you, even if it's not specifically a photo shoot?
Yeah, not always. No. You know, sometimes the best camera is the one that you have in your back pocket.
Do you take a lot of iPhone or cell phone photography?
If need be, yeah, sure.
Is there somewhere that you would like to go or something that you would like to photograph that you haven't yet had a chance to? Like, what's on the list for next?
I'm getting ready to go to Africa again in November, and, you know, my bucket list is really deep. So right now I just kind of, you know, go where I'm planning, which is Africa for about a week. And beyond that, you know, I talk to other photographers and see what other people are taking photos of, and I just kind of get ideas through that. And then if I do stumble upon a location, well, then I'd start doing more research, Googling it, seeing the pictures that are coming out of that area, and, you know, if it's something that I want to take on.
Is there a photographer or some photographers that you look to for inspiration?
Not really. I think there's so many photographers out there now. You know, if you were talking 30, 40 years ago, then there would have only been, you know, probably a third of what there is now.
Yeah.
Everybody's a photographer because everybody's got an iPhone, everybody's got a camera, and everybody, you know, takes pictures. And there wasn't social media 30, 40 years ago. So you really had to be a photographer show people your work. You had to have exhibits and things like of that nature. You still do, but it's a lot easier. Everybody can be a photographer and post things on social media. Now you're exposing, you know, your work to the world through social media, where really great photographers that did it for a living didn't have that outlet back then.
That was Baseball Hall of Famer Randy Johnson. He'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe tonight to talk about his book of photography called Experiencing Africa.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.